And welcome to The Truth About Fiction. I'm Lynn Michelle.
And I'm Derek Thompson.
And we're going to talk about the whole hard, grinding business of being a writer, of writing and being published.
We're going to shatter some myths, break some hearts, and hopefully bring you something inspiring. But most of all, we will tell it how it is.
Yes, I'd like to tell the truth because there's quite a lot of myths out there about the writing process and about being a writer. I think you and I can tell it how it is. So, first of all, you're a writer, but what is a writer?
Well, there's this popular view that anybody who writes is a writer. And I think there's some truth in that, you know, by definition. But I also think that the term writer is bandied about, and I think it implies some level of commitment.
Yes, and judging by the submissions that come in, and now I'm wearing my hat as the person who runs Linen Press, a lot of people out there think they are writers, but I'm not sure that they understand the complexities and the commitment and all the other stuff that goes into it. So this is where we maybe dishearten a few folk. I mean, I like the word commitment from you.
Well, the interesting thing, I think, is that, you know, another trope is that the first draft is for the writer and the second draft is for everybody else, but principally the editor. And I think that the first time that you get your darling book sort of massacred by an editor is like having your heart broken. But always, absolutely always, the result at the end of it is a far more enriched and a far better book than you ever would have produced on your own.
I'm not sure I would agree with that.
Well, that's what we're here for, the controversy. The question is, why do you write?
Let's go back to what we write, and it may be to do with what we write that we diverge on that idea about an editor knocking a manuscript into some sort of finished form. Let's go back to what you write. You tell me what you write. Do you have a box with a label on it that you live inside?
No. I had a conversation, an online conversation. It was a really brief one with somebody who writes literary fiction. And we just had an exchange of few words. And essentially what she was saying is that in her work as a literary author, she explores themes. And I don't. I mean, I write mainly in two genres, sort of pulp genres. But for me, it's about the character and it's about the voice. So if there are big themes, they're sort of woven in. But I don't start out with a theme like, I don't know, betrayal or the search for meaning. That I think certainly the search for meaning and understanding is present in a lot of literary fiction that I've read. I don't work that way. So for me, I sort of go where the story goes. I work within the framework of a genre, but I mean, you're a literary fiction author. I think it's different for you.
Tell me what you do write first, and then I want to go back to that idea of themes and you writing a story with characters, because I'm not sure there's that much difference between the two, but tell me what you write. I think of you as the person that writes the Thomas Bladen novels, but that's probably too narrow a box for you. So explain what you write, Derek.
Well, I mean, in terms of genres, I've written five spy novels, my take on a spy novel, which is a sort of I suppose it's a homage to Eric Ambler and Len Dayton. It's sort of working class fiction with a massive nod to Raymond Chandler, who I adore for his sort of hard-boiled style and language. I've also written a couple of crime mysteries, which probably owe a debt to Anne Cleave and the Vera novels. I've written a fantasy fiction novel that's so dense that I doubt whether more than 20 people have read it, and I include myself in that. I've read it twice. But something you said really hits true for me, and I suppose it goes back to school days. I write stories, so it's all about the story and where the story goes, and often the story itself determines the end point. I don't start off with a clear idea. I want to write a story about the search for meaning or existential crises. I suppose I start small. I mean, I usually start with one person in a room, and as a writer, I sort of interrogate them and say, what are you doing? Or I eavesdrop on a conversation on the page. What about you? How do you start?
Well, I don't think it's very different, Derek. The person you spoke to about literary fiction sounds very like me, but I've been all over the place. I'm a publisher's nightmare. I started off with a writing scheme for schools, which was great fun, took 3 years, six illustrated books and teachers' books. And I did all the drawings, and then they were redone by the team at the publishers. So I did a writing scheme for primary schools. And then I wrote some books where I wrote the stories of groups of people who were unable to have a voice for themselves. So the first one was children living with passive smoking. This was long ago, long before the big pharmaceutical tobacco company, long before the big tobacco companies were busted by research and evidence. So I wrote a book about children as passive smokers, and they told me their feelings and their stories, and I put them all together. So that was one. And the other one, big one, because I had ME for a very long time, as did my two sons, and we were stuck in the ME ghetto for years and years and years. As I emerged, I interviewed 30 people with ME of all ages, all backgrounds, some desperately ill, and all within about a 5-10 mile radius of where I lived in Scotland. So it was prevalent. And then I tried to tell, well, I did, I told their stories in a book called Shattered, Life with ME. So that related a lot to my previous life as an academic, where I was more of a sociologist, listening to people's stories and then giving them a voice. So I did that, and then I shifted into fiction, and that's where I've been recently and still am, and thoroughly enjoying myself, interrupted by a biography, which I wasn't really very different from writing fiction. But my story, I've written four novels now. I don't think I'm very different from you in that I start not with any big themes, although I'll come back to those. I start with characters. Like you say, characters in a room, no. They're characters in a landscape, and they start talking, and the story runs from there. I think the characters run with the story rather than me telling the story.
Well, it does sound very similar. I mean, do you feel when you write that you're sort of, I don't want to get all Jungian here, especially because I wouldn't know what I'm talking about, but do you feel that all the characters are you?
No, none of the characters are me. They may have elements of me. And the more I've written, and as I've gone through the process of four novels, I think I'm moving further and further away from myself and my own experiences. But coming back to the themes, they're definitely hanging underneath. They're hanging underneath the stories. And there are big themes. For me, the theme of roots, belonging, of being an outsider and what it means, themes of place, all that stuff. But I don't start there. I think that's already hanging at some level. It's like when you swim And it's underneath, deep underneath the water, something swims with me. So although I'm on the surface writing the story, my characters are talking, those themes come along with me, and they're always with me. Does that make sense?
It does. Do you think they're always the same themes or similar themes? I mean, you've mentioned, you know, roots and belonging and the sense of the outsider and place. Do you think that it's always those? Does it change how?
It changes a bit, but those are the key themes, the sort of main themes that in retrospect, when I go back and read the finished book, I see those themes. I may not be aware of them at the time, but looking back through what I've written, oh yeah, that's about place and that's about not belonging or belonging. But they started differently. My first novel began with my 98-year-old father telling stories about his time in active service, when everything else was fading, when the present was going. Those times were very clear. And he endlessly told me stories about World War II and his time in Kenya fighting the Mau Mau. And in the end, I said, Dad, sit down. I'll type this up. And let's capture these stories once and for all and stop telling me the same stories. And that's how that one started. That turned into White Lies. That was my first novel about, who spans four decades, a soldier in World War II, about different kinds of war and different kinds of loving. It's about a love affair as well. So how did your first one start?
First novel started in my teens, and which is embarrassing when you consider I didn't get the final version up until 2000 and something or other. But it was a sort of it was based in a way. I had this good friend of mine, and we were very different, and that difference is what sort of drove the novel. And again, about the place of the outsider, that he was heading in a particular direction in life and I wasn't. And I always loved sci-fi and fantasy fiction. And I loved all the sort of esoteric themes like a lot of teenagers do. And that was the beginning of it. And it became, I mean, at one point, I think it was about 130,000 words as a novel, but it developed, if that's the right word, along certain lines and became a very dense esoteric novel. I suppose I wouldn't call it autobiographical, but there were bits in there that were me. And it's interesting that you say as time goes on with the books, there's less and less of you, because I feel like mine, it's more interesting to explore characters as themselves and not see them with bits of us or look for bits of ourselves. But I think most people's first book, I venture to suggest, is, you know, they're talking about themselves, because why wouldn't you? You know, we talk about what we know, and the thing that we know best or think we know best, sometimes we find out on the page that's not the case, is ourselves. I was struck by something that you said when you mentioned, I'm just coming back to roots, belonging, outsider and place, because we've had many conversations prior to setting this up about your role both as an author and a publisher. And I wonder whether you have that sense of belonging, or whether you feel you're an outsider, and how, what you feel your place is in the publishing industry and in the world of authors.
Oh, as a publisher, I'm an outsider. Oh, it echoes from the writing to the publishing. I run Linen Press, which is a tiny independent women's press, the only one UK-wide left. All the others have been swallowed by the big publishers and hang underneath as imprints. So I'm very much an outsider. There's only me. It's a one-woman band. And increasingly, the gap widens and widens between the big five publishers, as you know, and the independent presses, which have grown up in a different territory because they take risks, they don't have money, they take on writers that the big P's would not accept. But I notice sea change, and I think it's recent. I was talking to someone who runs the Contemporary Small Press the other day, and she said, when the independent presses first started up, it was thought that they published rubbish and the big publishers published the good stuff. And now that's been reversed. And she thinks that the perception from outside is that the big publishers are churning out the rubbish, and the formulaic novels and the crowd pleasers and really very superficial material. Not all, that's a huge generalization. But the independent publishers are the ones who are producing the really interesting books, picking up the writers with different voices, the minority group writers. So I think there is a sea change going on, but at the moment I feel very much an outsider. I have no funds, no funding. I don't pay myself. I've been doing this for 15 years, and anything I earn from books goes back into the next publication. But the joy, the rewarding part of it is seeing an author, watching an author who's never been published, produce something really exciting and interesting and express herself in a way that's not been heard before. So I hope that my risk-taking pays off and that the books on my list are very... No, I don't know how to go on, Derek. I'm boasting because it's my press. I'm very proud of my audience.
Yeah, what you're saying is you're doing something different, and that your driver is not commercial, it's not the bottom line, it's a sense of satisfaction and purpose. Do your authors stay with you? Do they branch out to other publishers subsequently? How does it tend to run?
Most of them stay with me. One or two have, at the moment, are trying bigger publishers. With my blessing, they've told me. But others have come to me from big publishers, like Maureen Freely, who Maureen Freely used to be a Guardian and Observer columnist. She translates the Turkish poet, Nobel Prize winner. She's quite big. She had 6 novels published. And she came to me, it's about 6 years ago, and said, I've left my publisher. They're anti-intellectual, anti-literary. They're a bunch of Tesco salespeople. They refuse to edit. Can you help? And I said, yes. And so we set off with her 7th novel. I could see where she was struggling. And we had a wonderful time while she wrote that 7th, sailing through Byzantium. So that was lovely, her coming to me with exactly the reasons we've just been talking about. Really the failings of the big publishers to see the merit of a literary novel, a novel of ideas, a novel that needs some editing. And I do that, I will edit and edit and edit, and that's expensive. So that's why the big publishers have, most of them seem to be dropping that stage. I'll tell you about my experience with that later.
Did her sort of back catalogue, or you know, her sort of renown as an author, did that help Linen Press when it came to publishing the 7th novel and sort of getting publicity and raising the profile?
Oh yes, hugely. It was a quite different process with Maureen. She came with an agent, a big agent, the agent who discovered Life of Pi, and had been able to retire to Tuscany on the proceeds. So he was gracious and helpful, and he wined and dined me, which is not something that ever happens. And when it came to publicity, I don't know whether I should say this, just I will. I will tell the truth here, as I've promised. I said, shall I start contacting newspapers? He said, no, leave it with me. I'll pick up the phone. And so we had reviews in all the the mainstream newspapers. We had Book of the Year, we had reviews everywhere, and he organised the launch at Daunt, where I'd been turned down time after time. And it was all laid on with wine and hundreds of people there, and it was just gorgeous. It was a wonderful launch. So when an author comes with a reputation like that, and she's my biggest by a long way, the landscape changes completely, and I get an insight into what it would be like to be a big publisher and not a tiny little fish swimming around this huge literary pool where I'm just a little minnow.
So would you say that in your experience, and particularly that experience, a lot of the success of publishing is about connections?
Yes, absolutely. And so I have to work very much harder to sell my emergent writers, my unknown writers, the writers that don't, particularly the writers that perhaps are reclusive like I am and don't have hundreds of contacts like Maureen had. So when I published Sailing Through Byzantium, this lovely agent told me that I had to send out 70 free copies. I said, 70? He said, yes, that's what you do at this level. So it was like a hierarchy. And I jumped many, many rungs up the publishing ladder, and I got a glimpse into what it was like near the top. But that's not normally how I operate.
That's interesting that you talk about a ladder, because I've been asked, as I'm sure you have in the past, other writers sort of approach you, particularly online, and if they're, well, the ones that are sort of behind you on the ladder, so to speak. And it's interesting that when you have books and they're visible online, that gives it a certain cachet, and people think, and yeah, if your books are on Amazon, other online retailers that pay tax are available, and they say, oh, you must be doing really well because your book is, yeah, I don't know, 10,000 in the charts.
Yes.
I mean, I look upon it like football. I see my, and I know nothing about football, as anyone who ever kicked a ball around with me will attest. But I see myself very much as now, because I've got a few books out there, I'm probably sort of League Division 4. And I've had an insight. Some of the authors with the same publisher are fantastically successful. They're very gracious people. You know, with we communicate periodically, and you ask them about marketing or what they're doing and their writing process. And you can see, similar to yourself, you can sort of see nose pressed against the glass slightly, just as others behind have got their nose pressed to the glass looking at you. And you can see the sea change, the difference. And I think often we look for the formula, you know, if I did this or if I did that, would that change everything? Would I get a bestseller if? And it's another of those myths that really needs shooting. Some of it is luck, some of it is connection. And to quote an Americanism, we're not all going to the prom. And I think a lot of writers, when they first start out, particularly now in this saturated age of social media and everyone sort of offering a curated life, you know, so many times I've seen writers, they'll post online, they'll say, you know, what's your writing space like? And there'll be all these lovely desks. You know, there won't be an attic with basically papers and shit piled up on the floor, which is how I work, much to the chagrin of my partner. I think that we're looking for formulas often. I think that people are looking for, there is a sort of, there's an insider route. If I do X, Y, and Z, then it will all work out. And A, life doesn't work like that anyway for the majority of people. And B, the arts and writing certainly doesn't work like that. And I think that's another, there are no guarantees. There are fewer rules than we're told, but there are gatekeepers, I think.
There are definitely gatekeepers. And I want to add to those things you said, the connections, the luck, the being the right voice at the right time. But there's something else, Derek, was money. this is a commercial game and increasingly a commercial game. And what I don't have are the funds to do the marketing. So let me give you another example. Where the Crawdad Sing, the novel that has gone sky high to a Hollywood movie about an illiterate girl living a wild life in the swamps. It has become massive. A lot of money has been thrown at that novel. It's huge. It's as far as it's gone all the way up. If you think of it as the ladder, it's gone up the ladder and it's gone now into the ether. I have a very, very similar novel on my list called Sometimes a River Song. It's about an illiterate girl living in Arkansas in a river community who has to escape. It's about nature and her striving to get away by becoming literate. It's almost the same story. In fact, I've had several people who've written in to say, has the author of Crawdads stolen the story from Apple Joy's story? Well, I don't know. I can't possibly. I'm not certainly not getting involved in that. But Avril's story, Sometimes a River Song, is at least as good and as beautiful and as compelling as Where the Crawdads Sing. And what's missing? Money. I've not been able to buy the huge advertising posters. I've not been able to get hold of the people in the newspaper reviewing departments. I haven't been able to throw finance at it. It should be up there too. And it's hovering down at the bottom, as you say, and I love your football analogy. Sometimes a River Song, I think, is one of the best books on my list, but it's definitely League Four in terms of visibility and its reach. But in terms of its quality and its beauty, it's right up there with Manchester United, Liverpool. How can you not like football, Derek, when we've just had the Euros and gone out on penalties? All right, we won't talk about that.
I used to live near Leighton Orient.
Okay.
Quickly, this is about as you've been viewed as a football. Apologies
to Leighton Orient. I'm afraid it is so much about the power of advertising, especially with social media, as you say. It's the advertising departments, the marketing departments in the big presses are enormous. Their power is huge. I have none of that. I can't even begin. And I feel bad about it. I feel guilty. I feel sad that I can't push the novels that are that good out into the universe and light them up with great big stars around them, because some of the novels deserve that visibility and that fame.
But there are, I mean, mathematically even, there are only ever going to be so many seats around the top table, you know, whether that's authors, yes, footballers, artists, whatever. So it must be very strange for Avril to think, well, she's obviously told a story that resonates with people because there's a similar story that's having great success. And on the one hand, that must be sort of gratifying, and on the other, maddening.
Avril is wonderfully calm about it. She's one of my most loyal authors, and she says, I'm quite content. She worked for 25 years in a woman's prison, and she sat in on a creative writing class in her 60s, early 60s. And she started writing, and she's since then been listed for most of the big prizes. I mean, not the huge prizes, but the Bath novel, People's Prize. She scooped prizes and she's been listed. And she said, I'm just content to have found you. She's so loyal to Linen Press. We get on extremely well. And when I edit, we're so much on the same wavelength. She says, feels no resentment at all. I'm the one that feels the guilt. I think she's never ever said to me, you haven't done well enough. I'm the one that feels that, not her.
Well, as you say, I mean, you can only work within the resources and connections that you have. It's interesting. I mean, this is a slight tangent, but it is sort of relevant that, you know, people who are impoverished sort of carry, or socially deprived, they carry this sense of guilt or shame. And yet some of it is just luck of the draw. You know, you're born into an environment and the resources that you have at hand or what's normalized for you, and that's what you have to deal with. I wonder also if ambition is an interesting theme, you know, in terms of Avril, where age plays a part. I mean, I know my first commercial genre novel standpoint came out in 2000 and trying to remember 15, and obviously the landscape was very different in my 20s or 30s, as was I, and you know, there weren't ebooks. I mean, my books have thrived because they're ebooks, because they're sort of 1.99 or even 99p, and because the prevalence of e-readers and the domination of Amazon. But I wonder if Avril or any of us had yearned for more success in our younger days. So I wonder how much age plays a part in our ambitions and tempering those ambitions.
No. I would replace ambition with a need to write. And Avril has, and I, we have a strong urge, need to write. And when we don't have a project, we feel something's missing. We get up in the morning and only half the world is there. When we go into our imagined worlds, and when we inhabit them, then the world becomes complete again. So I don't think I would call that ambition. When I was young, I think it felt much the same. It was a need to get something down, and the sheer pleasure of writing, and of not just writing, of crafting the writing to the point where you're somewhat happy with it. So no. So you're saying that you felt more ambitious when you were young, but is that a reality check? Going back to what we've been saying about how hard it is to be famous.
I wouldn't say I was more ambitious as a writer when I was young. But I think if I'd had the League Division 4 success that I'd had now when I was younger, I would have been more ambitious. You know, I mean, I sort of think, well, I'd like to see one of my novels is, my ambitions at the moment, I'd like to see an audiobook. Actually, that's a contradiction in terms. I'd like to be able to go on a long car journey and stick on an audiobook of one of my novels, if only so I could criticise the narrator. I suppose that what I'm really saying is, do you write to be read, or do you write for the pleasure or therapeutic benefit or the exploration of writing?
Oh, it has to be both. It has to be both. I want to be read. I want people to recognise themselves, their stories and my stories. I want people to relate to the characters that I create. No, it's not just for me at all, Derek. It's definitely a two-part process. I want to reach people. And yes, secretly, I, like you, I don't want to put the tape in the cassette thing in the car. I would like to go into a bookshop and see my books there. So yes, probably I'm just as ambitious, but either I'm denying it or I'm pushing it away so that I don't admit to it quite so obviously. Yes, I want to be read, Derek, I really do, because I think I have something, I suppose I have to believe I have something to say.
I think for me one of the greatest pleasures was it was one of the novels, in fact I think it might be the one that hasn't come out yet, which at time of recording, the working title is Past Redemption. It's a crime mystery. I sent it to my one of my beta readers, a kind of super fan. So if you ever listen to this, Sarah, there's a name check for you. And she read the book, as she always does, and she made a couple of comments. And one of the comments told me that she'd not only read the book, but she'd sort of got it. I think it was a particular line. It was, I don't know if it was a clever line, but it was a what I hope was a well-considered line. Excuse me, choked up with emotion. And she got it. And I think for me as a writer, it's that idea that you're sort of wrapping up a mystery in a story. You know, maybe this is where the themes actually become apparent. You're trying to say something without directly saying he, she was sad or they were yearning for something. You're implying something with varying degrees of subtlety. And when a reader comes back to you, and that is one of the joys of social media, but when a reader comes back and says, am I right in thinking that that character, something had happened to them, or they were trying to do something because of something else, and you haven't actually said that on the page, but you meant that. When they get that, it's like someone has cracked the code. I mean, that's happened twice to me, and that was probably one of the most satisfying things ever as a writer, that you can be subtle, you can credit your reader with intelligence, and they actually, you know, they manage to sort of open the puzzle and look at the prize within and come back to you and say, oh, I see what you were doing there. It was that. And you go, yes, at last, somebody's got it. And then it makes you feel as a writer that, you know, perhaps you know your craft to some extent. You know, perhaps there's hope for the next book.
I agree. Absolutely. When I read reviews that say beautifully, describe beautifully the themes that maybe even I wasn't aware I was writing about, and then yes, they've really got it, and they've read into it even more than perhaps I knew was there, and their eloquence in describing what I've written is so, it's just so lovely, and it makes it all worthwhile. I think what we've been talking about is how complex this whole business is, and maybe it's a bit of a downer for those out there who think, oh, you just sit down and you write and then it's done. It's not like that. It's multidimensional. The process is multidimensional. It has all these facets. And then getting your book out there is even more multidimensional and has all the elements that you talked about, the opportunity, the connections, me talking about backing, finance, marketing. Given how many submissions come in from writers, I'm getting one a day, sometimes two a day, three a day. Wow. They all think that they're writers, but first of all, so many of them have written their life stories and not disguised, not transformed into something that others would find interesting. And second, the writing's just not exciting or beautiful or amazing. And I worry that they're proliferating. The number of people out there who think they're that they are able to write is I can't say it. The number of people who think they are, thank you. The number of people who think they are writers, I wonder, does it matter that they are not, or is it enough that they've written something even if it's not very good? And I've said no thank you to them, because I say no thank you to hundreds and hundreds of writers.
Well, that's another interesting point. I mean, I've had, over the years, I've had, unsurprisingly, a lot of rejections because I've made a lot of submissions. And occasionally I get useful feedback. Most of the time, and you'll appreciate this, there just isn't time. And sometimes you don't get any response at all. I think the longest I've waited was about a year and 3 months. They did say on the website, it can take us a long while to respond. But I mean, I mean that was prize winning, really. I think it was 1 year, 3 months and 2 weeks. It was a no.
That is denying your involvement with the story. When you've written a story, there's a period afterwards in when you're still thoroughly immersed in it. And then at some point you have to let go, loosen the threads, cut the ties, and move on to the next project. So waiting a year and 3 months means you've left that one behind, you've moved on, you've gone a long way from it, so that's hopeless. I think maybe in the next session, Derek, we should talk about our experience of publishing and our experience of rejections and the whole journey through getting our books out there, which for me has been downhill. I've gone the wrong way. Normally you start on the level ground and you climb up through base camp one and you should end up on top of Everest. But I started on top of Everest and I've been on my way down ever since, which may be the changing literary landscape or it may be me. But perhaps next time around, and again, it's going to be a bit painful for those listening in, we could describe our publishing journeys. Mine is long. It's about 30, 35 years of starting on the snowy, sunlit caps of Everest and finding myself back at base camp, sending out my latest novel and getting my rejections. So that might be a good topic for next time.
Yeah, so what we're saying to any listeners is bring yourself a hot drink, plenty of chocolate or red wine, and dig in.
Yes. I think you need some comforting things around you for our next podcast. But as always, we will tell the truth and we'll tell it how it is. And maybe we'll get some feedback that tells us another story.
That would be interesting. I mean, that's the other thing. I think the more people talk about this, I mean, which is not to say it's a terrible industry or art to be part of. I find it amazing and supportive and transformative and adventurous. But however, even if it's not deliberate, you can't disguise the dent on your forehead when someone shoves a door in your face, basically.
I think that's a lovely trend. I think the dent in the forehead, or perhaps a whole row of dents in the forehead, is a nice image to leave this.
It is, with. And that too is part of the process. So
there are the dents in the forehead, but there is also the dancing around the room when you get an acceptance or a lovely review. So we're not all depressing.
No, not by any means. Right, well, I look forward to speaking with you next time.
You too, Derek. Okay, bye for now. That went